And welcome to another edition of the Odyssey Radio Show. We talk about metaphysical topics and ancient mysteries and unsolved, unfiltered news from all around the world. So today we're really going to delve into the ancient astronaut theory. I have a fascinating guest named Eric Parker. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Okay, why don't you tell us a bit about your background and kind of summarize the general ancient astronaut theory for our audience.
Okay, well, currently I'm working as a stockbroker in Los Angeles. I have a family and a daughter. But related to the subject of ancient astronauts, I work for the author Zachariah Sitchin as his webmaster and as a seminar coordinator. And basically the theory and the information that we've been finding by looking at the archaeological record of recorded documents that are recorded either on clay or on stone tablets tell a story of our history that has not been passed down to us. Well, maybe I should say it's been passed down to us, but in the form of religious and biblical stories. And when you look at the original documents that are the source of all of those stories, we find a lot more information in them than they should have for the fact that they're so old. The ancient astronaut theory is very simple, that a lot of the events of the past, religious experiences and other sightings, were misidentified by primitive people, and they saw things and, of course, called them gods. And so in their process of mistranslating, they misidentified what was really people coming from other planets or other places in our solar system and visiting Earth, and of course thought of them as God or the gods.
Absolutely, that makes sense to me. So let's talk a bit about some of the books that didn't quite make it in the Bible.
Okay.
Like, for instance, the Book of Enoch was in the Bible for a while, but I believe that the powerful Roman Church of the day really wanted to get rid of that book. Why don't we get into what the Book of Enoch talks about?
Well, the Book of Enoch is actually, it's extremely old. The problem with the timeline or the physical evidence of the book is that we don't have a very, very, very old source or an original old source. Now, what's in the Bible today was canonized in two different sections or two different time frames. The Old Testament was canonized in the 400 to 500 B.C. range when the Israelites and the exiles came back from Babylon. And under the auspices of the priest Ezra and Nehemiah, codified the Old Testament. The New Testament was canonized by the Council of Nicaea in 325 A.D. under the, the authority of Constantine, the emperor in Rome. And that's when they decided what books would be in the New Testament and what books would be out, and which ideas of divinity and ideas of all theology were established at the time. So the Old Testament and the Book of Enoch, along with, let's say, the Book of Jubilees, which was not put into the Bible, and here's one that was not put in, called the Book of the Wars of Yahweh.
Okay.
So during the Israelite Exodus, after the Israelites crossed the Sea of Reeds, which is usually called the Red Sea, which actually in Hebrew it's the Sea of Reeds, and the sea is split, and they survive and the Egyptians die, they pray to God and they celebrate and they sing. And it says there in the text, if you want to find more information, you can look into the book called The Book of the Wars of Yahweh, and Yahweh being the name of the biblical God. So that's at least three books that are not part of the official Bible now that were referenced in previous texts.
Right.
The Book of Enoch specifically talks, Enoch takes a trip in a journey. Enoch is mentioned in the Old Testament as one who walked with God. And in his book, he actually goes on a journey to the planet of some of these gods. And he has a very, incredible adventure.
Right, but he also talks about 200 fallen angels, correct, that descend to the earth and that interbreed and have sexual relations with humans.
Well, he does, and the fallen angel term is actually a mistranslation from the original Hebrew term.
Okay.
The original Hebrew term for those characters that are now called fallen angels was Nephilim. Nephilim is a root, the word Nephal in Hebrew is to fall, and in the context of the way it's describing it, it's fallen ones in plural form who have come down. That word is also the same that the Anunnaki, well, the term Anunnaki also means people that from heaven to earth came or characters that came down. The Anunnaki term is how the Sumerians described those characters that were not the top gods, but they were a different level of god. In other words, they were a lower level of ranking, but they weren't the commanding level. And in Hebrew, the term got switched to Nephilim, the fallen ones.
I see.
And the reason that the flood was given in the Bible the disaster of the flood that Noah survived.
Right.
The reason for that is described as these characters coming to Earth, having sex with the daughters of man, which is interbreeding, and then that was offensive to the god.
So they wanted to wipe the slate clean and start over?
That's correct. That was one of the reasons for the flood. Now, in the older documents that we look at, for example, the flood story, that was not the reason for the flood. The flood was a natural impending disaster that these Anunnaki or these gods or these astronauts knew about, but they didn't want to save every human. They only saved their favorite humans.
I see.
And Noah is the name of this favorite human in the Bible. In the older text that the Bible borrows from, Noah has three different names in different languages, depending on which culture the text is written in. Utna Pishtim, Ziasudra, and Atrahasis. The most famous is probably the Atrahasis text. All of these are the same character, whose God told him that there's going to be a flood, please save yourself, build yourself a vessel, and escape and survive.
Okay, now, when I study this material, I always see artifacts and art left behind of half-animal, half-human hybrids.
Mm-hmm.
What do you believe this represents? Is this genetic manipulation before the flood, or what is this?
Yeah, actually, that is correct. What happens is very simple. The Bible picks up a story of God creating Adam from the rib of Eve, creating Adam from the dust of the ground, creates Eve from the rib of Adam, and from blood and soil and this kind of mixture. Well, that story is actually borrowed from an older source. And we know that where the source is because we have those tablets, and these tablets are in the original form, either in clay or in stone. So what happens is there's a very long, detailed story in the tablets that are found and now and sitting in museums and dug up and all over the world in different places. So yes, there was genetic manipulation to create the human race because there was a need for a worker, because these Anunnaki astronauts or gods were revolt. They had a revolt because they did not want to work and they did not want to conduct their mining operations, which they had already done for hundreds of years, and they complained. So the need to create a primitive worker was established. They agreed to create it from what was on the earth at the time, let's say hominids, standing upright hominids that are not Homo sapiens sapien yet, and they bound the identity of the god with this hominid, which we know now as a DNA or genetic manipulation, blending together the two races. Now, this is significant because they did not succeed right away in creating a model man, whose, by the way, name was Adamu, or the root of the word Adam.
Okay.
They spent a lot of time working and trying to get the right mixture, and in the process, they made mistakes, and they described the mistakes. They described the mistakes in the text, and pictures also have these mistakes, like you mentioned, half-man, human type of looking characters. They created humans that couldn't eat. They created humans that didn't know anything but run around. They couldn't take instructions. It took a long time before they created the model man. And when they got the formula right, then they had birth goddesses impregnated them with a part of the DNA of themselves, these Anunnaki ancient astronauts, and then what was already on the Earth at the time.
Okay, now the Egyptian art, which has all of these animal-human hybrids like the Sphinx, was after the flood. So how would they have known about these genetic manipulations before the flood?
Well, the Sumerian tablets have a lot of history that occurs before the flood. That's why this evidence is so compelling and significant. It is still available. It is still in single pieces, and it tells a lot of the story of what happened before. There's hundreds of thousands of years of descriptions of things that occurred before the flood came. Now, all of those ancient memories, all of those ancient stories survive with the people that live and survive through the disasters. And that's the impetus for the artwork that we see later. They're telling the story of the history that they knew at the time. They are not creating at that moment a new fantastical, unreality-based event. They are recording what they remember and what the stories were passed down as.
That makes a lot of sense.
And a lot of times what happens is, an archaeologist, a scientist who looks at something and says, well, obviously they could not have had human animal hybrids. It's a made-up story.
Right.
But it wasn't made up to the artist who drew it. To him, that was the story. That was his history.
because it took so long to make these artifacts. They put so much effort into them.
Yeah, and there's a lot of artifacts that we find that have information on them that should not exist in the time frame that they're in. You see, a lot of, if there was no advanced information found, then fine, you could probably say it was made up. But when you see stuff that has processional numbers, knowledge of the zodiac, knowledge of things that they should not have known 4,000 BC, 3,000 BC, then you start to say, well, where did they get this advanced knowledge from? And there's tablets that have incredible information on it, where they calculate processional numbers going up to 12,960,000.
Amazing.
And they divide it downward to the lowest possible denominator, but what they get to is the exact processional number in our processional cycle. And our processional number is 25,920 years.
Which is the Mayan calendar.
That is correct. And each cycle is 2,160 years. What's interesting is the system that the Sumerian mathematical system was called sexagesimal. The only way to divide these numbers up and have even numbers and not have odd numbers or decimals is to use their system of sexagesimal, which takes 6 times 10 and then times it by 6. But guess what? That's what we use today. When you go to buy bagels or donuts, you buy a dozen. That's 2 times 6.
That's why it's that weird number.
That's 12. The calendar month, 12 calendar months, 12 disciples of Jesus, 12 tribes of Israel, 12 Olympian gods. Every time when a person sees 12, or hours in the days, 24 hours, it's 4 times 6, or 2 times 12.
12 inches and a ruler.
That's correct. Everything that's divisible by 12 goes back all the way to the Sumerian mathematical system, which is they got that information from their Anunnaki gods, or these ancient astronauts, and that's what they were taught to use. They didn't use base 10 like we do because we have 10 fingers and 10 toes. They used something different that's not natural to the human body. But
right.
It's better for counting giant numbers.
Uh-huh.
And they can divide these incredible distances in time.
That makes sense. Now, let me ask you about what the Anunnaki looked like. When I research this, I get two different descriptions. I get these old men with white beards and large eyes, and then I also get reptilian type of creatures. What do you make of this?
Okay, well, here's what's happening. You've got two different ways of depicting ancient gods in the ancient world. First of all, they did depict some mythological characters from their own stories, like monsters. But the Anunnaki themselves are always depicted in the oldest form as humanoid-looking, just like us, usually with beards, very tall, always taller than the humans. And even if a person looks on my own website, which is ericparker.com, with all Ks, E-R-I-K-P-A-R-K-E-R, ericparker.com, there will be depictions there under the slide presentation that shows what those characters look like. When they depicted reptilians, those were referenced to be two different types of characters. One, they had this like a monster-type character, but they also had these beings that were, well, the only way to say it is robotic or android beings. And these robotic android beings are described in the text as having medical knowledge. Now, when this goddess Inanna Ishtar died and 3 days later was resurrected, she was resurrected by these beings, or these android-type characters, which are described, and they don't really have their own sort of soul. They're just kind of programmable-type beings. And they are depicted a lot as reptilian-looking.
Okay.
And so they're not saying that the gods were reptilian, because they do depict the gods specifically looking humanoid, but they also depict sometimes flying characters. And when they depict a flying character, they add wings and sometimes a beak and a face like a bird, but it's just a reference to the ability to have flight.
I see, because we have so much mythology about dragons all around the world, in China and Europe. Do you believe that was based on an actual character?
Well, yes. See, the oldest story... Okay, here's what happens. What Zachariah Sitchin is researching and what I'm researching is the oldest recorded event of a certain story. And how do we know how old it is? Because the tablet is written in a certain language, and we have the original tablet. We're not talking about parchment. We have the original form that the scribe wrote. So when we look at that, there are descriptions of characters like Gilgamesh and Enkidu, who is the friend of Gilgamesh, who goes and searches out for whatever he's looking for, and they find things like monsters, and they have to fight them because these monsters are stopping them from going on their mission. Okay? And these monsters later on become the dragons and other descriptions of these kind of characters in the past. So there's always an original source of something that comes later.
Okay, so but what you're saying is these original monsters were fantasy characters, some of them.
Well, no. I mean, they were described in the stories as a monster, but they are a real part of the story. See, here's the problem. If you look at a story and the story says, oh, this god landed, this god gave us information, he taught us how to cultivate and farm and dig canals and do irrigation. Well, why didn't the king take credit for that? The king took credit for battles. The king took credit for successes all over the place. But in these cases where the oldest knowledge was passed down, these texts say everything we learned from the Anunnaki, which are these ancient astronauts. At the same time, there's information given that they should not know that's very advanced. So when they're describing a story of them trying to get somewhere and there's a monster stopping their way and they have to fight the monster, the story is their history. The monster, we don't know exactly what its nature was.
Right.
It could have been a robotic guardian. It could have been an animal-type thing that they had involved with. We just don't know. But they're not described as fantasy monsters. In the case, they are in the stories, they are described as real parts of the story, and they act as a impetus for action to happen in the story. A battle to take place, you know, and they have to conquer the monster to go beyond to the next mission, so to speak.
Well, we certainly know there's dinosaur bones all over the world, and they're kind of like monsters. Could it have been something like that?
That's correct. And I don't know if you're aware of this, but in Texas, in the Lubbock River, there are footprints that are human footprints in the limestone original lava bedrock. I'm sorry, under the limestone in the lava bedrock of the original, you know, the original flooring or ground. There's dinosaur footprints and human footprints. And the human footprints that they find are of the modern human foot, and they are large, 12 inches to 18 inches, with all toes normal, the heels normal, and alongside them is dinosaur footprints. Now, somebody was hunting somebody. We're not sure if the human was hunting dinosaur or vice versa, but in Lubbock River in Texas, they have several miles of these tracks, and they were not found at the top. The limestone had developed about 6 inches to 12 inches on top of the oldest lava bedrock, and they had to take off the limestone, and under the limestone they see these tracks. So human footprints and dinosaur prints together in the same strata.
That's amazing. Now let's talk about giants of the Old Testament. I know they were fierce warriors. Why do you believe they died out, and do you believe they are the same characters as the Nephilim?
Well, actually, yes. I believe the Nephilim are the same as the Anunnaki. And what happens is this. The term for, okay, the sound Anunnaki, that word, in Hebrew, the sound of those letters becomes the word in Hebrew for giant. In giant Hebrew is Anakim, or Anak. It's also, Anak would be a singular giant, and Anakim is the plural. The Anunnaki had their leader called Enki. When you look at the vowels and the consonants, what you see is the same sounds occur. So Anunnaki or Enki became Anak and Anakim. So here's what you've got. These characters, Anunnaki, were tall. They were gigantic. But when the translations came through thousands of years of spoken language and different texts and different cultures copying the stories, the sound of Anunnaki, the sound of Enki, became the word in Hebrew for giant, Anak, Anakim. But the description of Anunnaki, those who from heaven to earth came, became the word Nephilim. So one Hebrew word kept the meaning of the word, and one Hebrew word kept the sound of the original word. It's like a word pyramid. At the top you have Enki, Anunnaki, one side Nephilim, one side Anakim, and here you get to a description of giants and a description of fallen ones from the same original root word. So yes, these guys were giants. And when the Israelites were going into Israel led by Joshua, actually, before they're led by Joshua, they send spies into Israel, and they come back, and it says, oh, my God, we're like grasshoppers to these people. We can't defeat them. And God gets mad and sends them on a 40-year journey around the desert.
Right.
So during this time, what's happening in Israel? All we know is that by the time Joshua leads the Israelites into Israel, there's a few giants left. Og, king of Bashan, is the famous one. And then David fights another one later on, Goliath. And by the way, the term Goliath is a Sumerian word. It means its term, original root is Goliath, which basically means a great one.
I see. Now, and then Samson, I believe, was a giant too.
Well, Samson, Well, actually, Samson was a human who had that long hair, you remember?
Right.
His strength somehow was tied to his not cutting his hair,
mm-hmm.
which is there's like a religious thing behind, if you don't cut the hair, somehow you can be strong. That story has passed down for thousands of years.
Sure, but you mentioned them going out in the desert for 40 years. Do you believe this God character of Jehovah was one of the Anunnaki gods?
Well, you see, that's what's funny. I'll tell you why. The Anunnaki gods display a lot of behavior that Yahweh of the Bible also displays. Yahweh of the Bible takes them on military exercises. They go to war at his request. They fight and they kill, and they take over the land of Israel. But there's times when the biblical God acts very different from those Anunnaki characters. But also, this biblical God says, you should not have any other gods before me. I am your God. I am the Lord. But for the reason that I took you out of Egypt. He never says, I'm the Lord because I created the earth, I created the heavens. That's a misconnection between our theology of God creating everything and the actual stories that the Bible has. When you look at the stories of the Bible, you see a relationship between a people and a single God who has sent his people to go to war against other people and other gods. So Yahweh of the Bible was against all the other Anunnaki gods. He tried to, they tried to destroy the Egyptians and their gods, and later on the Israelites, the Canaanites, and the local population gods. And throughout the history of the Old Testament, the God of the Bible is fighting with these Israelites to be the only God that they worship.
Right.
And actually, that's where the failure comes from. If a person would read the Bible without an emotional connection, you would see that the story is of a father telling his children to listen to me, them disobeying them, him punishing them, he gives them another chance, and the cycle keeps repeating.
Sure. So you're saying at times this is the supreme God of the universe, and at other times it's an Anunnaki God?
Well, no. What happens is it's like that. We theorize, based on our theology, that this God character is the God of the universe. He doesn't claim to be.
No.
He doesn't act like he is.
He lives amongst them.
He does, but he doesn't live with them. The Anunnaki gods, you could go to him physically, you can ask the question, and he would give down the judgment. I don't know if you've heard of the law code of Hammurabi. Hammurabi is the code that is the predecessor of the Moses law code. In this Hammurabi code, the tablet that shows the event of him receiving the information, the god is sitting on the throne, and Hammurabi is standing there writing stuff down and contemplating and asking questions. That is not the same as the Yahweh God. With the Yahweh situation with the Israelites, only one person, one time a year on the holy day, could communicate with that god. Okay, the high priest had to go into the temple or in the tabernacle, and he could communicate. Except for Moses, who says he had a special connection to this character. Nobody has contact with this god. But in the stories of the Anunnaki, a lot of people have contact.
Right.
And they could go to them and ask a question of the god, and the god would present his edict, his ruling, or whatever, and tell them what to do. And they would write down that we asked the god, and this is what he told us to do. And when I say god, I mean god with a little g. Because they describe many characters who were in charge of different areas. One god was in charge of canals, one god was in charge of waterways and cultivating and all these different things.
Now, there's a main god called Anu, the father of Enki and Enlil. Could this have been Anu that they were talking about?
Well, yeah. See, the problem is that Anu was not even on Earth at the time. Anu was the chief god because he was the father of Enki and Enlil. Enki and Enlil were the two brothers, again, two brothers who fight for supremacy like Cain and Abel, okay? And each of them has a different command on Earth or different area of responsibility. And their father, Anu, comes to visit at a certain time. What's interesting is when he comes to visit, they start a new counting of a calendar. That counting of a calendar is where the Jewish calendar begins the counting 5,763 years ago from today. They think that that's the creation of the earth, but that was the beginning of the time when Anu visited earth. And the Babylonians and the previous cultures, the Akkadians, started a new calendar at that time. And so you have this event. Now, after he comes and leaves, there is no evidence that he comes back again. So he was not somebody that they could go to and interact with and ask questions of. Enki and Enlil were the top guys who anybody, they would give out information and tell them what to do.
I see. Now, let's move over to Mexico for a bit, because there's this benevolent teaching god who called Quetzalcoatl.
Mm-hmm.
And tell me a bit about him. And he, to me, he bears a striking resemblance to Enki. And sometimes he's described as reptilian, a feathered serpent. Other times he looks human, Caucasian, with a long beard.
Right. Well, the word Quetzalcoatl actually means plumed serpent. Plumed is like a big, fluffy outfit. So these guys dressed up in, you know, in extravagant outfits. Look, they knew that they were being treated as gods. They didn't say, no, I'm too modest, please don't. They were like, okay, if I'm going to be treated as a god, I'll probably act that way. But all of these old cultures, not just in Central America and South America, but in Mesopotamia and ancient Middle East, they all have these characters, these stories of these gods who come and teach them after the flood, the teachers from the sky,
sure,
or from the heaven. And Quetzalcoatl is one of them. But here's what's funny. The oldest culture in Mexico is the Olmec culture. The Olmec left behind these giant African-looking people, these heads that are like 8 or 9 feet tall, 6 or 7 feet wide. They are gigantic. But they left a lot of them, and they're all African-looking. So Zachariah did the research, and he found out that when you look back at the original counting of the old calendar, the old counting, you find that there's a specific starting date, I believe it's 3115 BC, which matches something that occurred in Egypt when one of the gods took his followers and left. And then the story picks up in Mexico with these gods coming, Quetzalcoatl and his followers, and giving knowledge back to the people and teaching them how to survive.
Right.
So we think that this Quetzalcoatl was actually an Egyptian god who was actually a Sumerian, or a, you know, these ancient astronauts who came across the ocean and decided to start civilization over here.
And Viracocha in South America.
Viracocha, and also
Tezcatlipoca. Well, he appears to be a more evil, warlike type of god.
You know, at different times, here's what happens. You color your history based on what's happening to you. If you believe that your god is responsible for the weather conditions, and you've survived, there are giant storms and floods, and you've had some bad times for a while, you believe that your god was evil and took ill on you. And
sure.
So you record the history based on that flavor of how you feel at the time. So, yeah, there's stories of these gods being fantastic, and then there's stories of them being kind of, evil and hurting people, which is the same thing as the Bible. In the Bible, God or the angels do, in fact, participate in their war and issuing sentences of retribution for sins done, and people are killed. And it's not at the hand of humans. It's at the hand of an angel or the god itself. So it's very same in that respect. A lot of times people, they don't either read everything or they don't look at it as, see, because they're wrapped up in their own belief system when you're looking at it, that it's hard to take yourself away from it and just look at it as a story and not be emotionally connected to it.
Absolutely. Now, let me switch gears on you, okay? We have, I want to talk about the Knights Templar, who had their heyday around 1200 AD, mm-hmm. much later. And I know they went to Solomon's Temple, which was built by Jehovah, mm-hmm. and they excavated there, and they found something very, very important.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe that they stumbled upon all this knowledge?
Well, here's the thing. I was studying Knights Templar before, like, the Da Vinci Code came out and things like this. The theory is this. There was some kind of knowledge there in the temple buried by Solomon, his son, or later generations. We used to think of it as the Holy Ark. Some people call it the Holy Grail. Okay, the Ark is not the same as the Grail. The Grail is two possibilities, either evidence or something that would provide immortality, like if Jesus drank from the cup and they believed the cup was holy, then if you drank from the cup, you could live. That's kind of the sort of the myth. But also, there's a theory that what they found was evidence that proves that the modern religion of Christianity was based on a change in the reality to a fictional story.
Exactly.
And so this information that the Knights Templar had, I personally believe, it's my personal belief, that showed that the Roman Catholic Church was not founded on such a solid story. So they found evidence, and they kept it, and therefore they had power and the ability to be their own kind of group within the structure of the Roman Catholicism.
Yeah.
Now, they still believed in Jesus and the Savior and that whole concept, but before the Council of Nicaea in 325 AD, there was many groups that had many different beliefs of Jesus, And the dominant theory was that Jesus was not divine, that he was a man. And he was a human man because if he was not human, his blood being spilt would not mean anything. If he was not human, his suffering would not mean anything. There was many views and many different groups that came out that fought for their ideology. But the ideology that eventually won was the Roman Catholicism and the Greek Orthodox ideology of Jesus is a divine person, the Holy Spirit, the Son, and the Trinity described the three different views rolled into one.
Right. Could it be that the Knights Templar discovered all about the Anunnaki because they had a lot of dragon mythology around them? Could that be the big secret?
Of course it's possible. And see, here's the thing. Now that we're looking back and we have the archaeological evidence, we see where these stories came from. I mean, I personally talk about how Moses' birth story was borrowed from the king Sargon the Great, king of Akkadia. The story about being born in a in secret, put into a basket, left to float. That's borrowed. The river turning to blood, the Nile River, is a borrowed story from Inanna Ishtar. Inanna was also died and resurrected 3 days later. Gilgamesh was the first character to claim that he was partially divine because his father was a human, but his mother was an Anunnaki goddess. All of these concepts exist in the old record. If the Knights Templar found this information, they would have a really strong evidence to basically get what they want by blackmailing.
Absolutely, and they ended up with all these castles, too,
over
Europe.
They established a system which, you had to give up all your wealth to become a Knight Templar, okay? Once you donated it, it became part of the group. So they were accumulating wealth as they accumulated members. But the way they accumulated members and the reasons why they became so powerful, that's still a secret. Of course, there's a lot of theories about it, that we're talking about now. So it's possible they had Anunnaki information. It's possible they got information about the real Jesus. It's possible they found some other artifacts which, tied religions together or religions apart.
Right, that all makes sense. We only have 5 or 10 more minutes. I have to get into Zechariah Sitchin's theory of this Nibiru planet that comes around every 3,500 years.
Mm-hmm.
Do you believe in that theory? And if so, wouldn't that mean it came around again at 1,500 B.C.?
Well, here's what happens. The orbital time frame is a 3,600-year orbit, and the reason it's 36 is, again, that's 360, which is degrees in a circle, times 10, 3,600. So 3,600 is a mathematical number. It's not that Zechariah thinks this. This is what the tablets say. The tablets talk about Nibiru, the planet of the passing. But until Zechariah realized it was a planet, all these people translating thought, well, maybe it's the galaxy, maybe it's Jupiter, maybe it's the solar system. We don't know what this Nibiru is. But it turns out that this Nibiru is described as the planet where the gods came from. And that planet with this long orbit, you're saying 1500 B.C., yes, it's possible that was the last time frame. There was an observation made in tablets in the year 555 B.C., and the planet was in a certain constellation. Zechariah thinks the next time that it comes closest to us is 2085, which means that the last time would be around 1500 B.C., give or take a few years. Remember, any object with an orbital period of 3,600 years is going to deviate 1 to 2% every time it comes around. So sometimes it's 33, sometimes it's 34, sometimes it's 37. It goes back and forth.
Now, do other scholars also believe this that look at the material, or is he somewhat alone or unique in this position?
Well, here's what's happening. There's an argument over what is Nibiru. You see, Nibiru is the planet of crossing, but the word planet in the Sumerian is in Hebrew, the word is kohav for star, but in Sumerian it's kakab. But it doesn't have to mean planet. It could be any astronomical object. So the moon could be the kakab of the moon. So the object is argued over of what this is.
Right.
Are they describing the galaxy? Is it the universe? And is it the solar system? Is it Jupiter? There's a lot of arguments about it. But Zechariah is really the one who brought together the different pieces to show that it's actually a planet, a single object.
That makes sense. Okay, now let me ask you about all the heavy weight of the objects. Like in the pyramid, this one stone is 70 tons, and the Olmec heads are, 10 or 20 tons. How did they carve out and move all these heavy pieces?
Well, let me tell you something. 70 tons is actually light in these ancient structures. We have pictures from Baalbek in Lebanon. Baalbek Zechariah took a tour to Baalbek where one stone is 1,100 tons. And 30 people can line up in front of the stone, and you can take a picture, and the stone is bigger than the 30 people. And the stones of these gigantic 1,100-ton sites that are in place are a mile and a half from the quarry. And we know where the quarry is because there's the stone sticking out of it still today. And in place at this temple in Baalbek, which is the greatest and grandest ancient temple besides the pyramid that existed, the Romans built the Temple of Jupiter. The biggest temple they built outside of the empire, inside of the home country of Italy, was on Baalbek in Lebanon, a stone platform where these giant stones, three of them, are not at the bottom, but at the third level up. Now, first the question, how did they move it? Second, why do they have to work with such stones? Why would you do it? If me and you were building something, we would build from the small stones that we can move and carry. They seem to have no problem dealing with the most gigantic stones.
Absolutely.
Stuff, and by the way, 1,100 tons, it can't be moved today except for straight up and straight down. We don't have a way today to move it a mile and a half. So they obviously had technology. Now, Egyptian artwork and ancient artwork shows some kind of technology that we still don't understand. It's possibly electricity. Possibly they used, I saw a theory where they used kites to move smaller stone or to raise obelisks. But still, to explain 1,100 tons, they obviously had a way of negating the gravitational effect of the stone and the earth. And somehow, with sound vibrations, with mental energy, with tools, we don't know exactly, but they lifted and moved them, and they put them in place perfectly, without space between them. I was in Malta, where I'm sitting in front of a gigantic stone that's 20 feet wide and 15 feet tall, but all the other stones are like more normal size. Why would you work with such a big stone, unless it was really easy for you?
Absolutely. Now, I have one more question, and the time has just flew by. I'm going to have you back.
Sure.
We just scratched the surface. But do you believe the Mayan calendar is accurate and that it ends at 2012?
Well, here's the thing. Yes, the calendar is ending in 2012, but that's not the end of Earth or the end of life. That's just the end of one cycle. The Mayan calendar has had many ends and many beginnings because it's been existed for several thousand years, plus it goes back in time for a long time. So, yes, there's the end of a cycle, and at that 2012 date, all of the planets are going to be on one side of the sun. I don't know if you're aware of this.
No.
There's going to be a straight line of all the planets. It's like a beginning point of the solar system cycle. So in that year 2012, I think it's in December, all the planets will be in the exact same side of the sun, lined up basically, well, you know, within a few degrees of each other.
Amazing.
So it's a brand new cycle now. Could it bring disaster? Yes, because if all the planets are on one side, you could have gravitational effects affecting the ice in Antarctica and the Arctic.
A pole shift, maybe.
You can have pole shifts. You could have a magnetic shift, which has happened many times. And by the way, the solar system out there has got a lot of problems with it. Does everyone know that Venus spins backwards?
Wow.
Venus spins the opposite way of every other planet.
Oh.
And Uranus is knocked sideways, so its magnetic field is pointing flat instead of up.
Right.
There are a lot of weird things in our solar system.
That is stunning. Why don't you give out your info one more time, and then I'm going to have to say goodbye to you, although I don't want to.
Sure. Well, anyway, my website is ericparker.com. It's E-R-I-K-P-A-R-K-E-R, ericparker.com. And or anybody can go to sitchin.com, which is the website that I manage for Zechariah, which is S-I-T-C-H-I-N, sitchin.com. And over there, there's plenty of pictures and slides and stories and a whole bunch of things. And anybody can send me an email through there and ask a question or give me some information that they know.
Well, thanks so much for being on the show, Eric. We'll talk to you later.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, that was Eric Parker, ericparker.com. And please check out his website and his material. He was a fantastic guest. As you know, on this show, we really dig into the ancient astronaut theory as much as we can from as many different angles as we can. We're on a real treasure hunt here to find out our true history, and I loved just picking his brain for 35 minutes. So we do a lot of that on the Odyssey show. I want to remind you we'll be playing again tonight, 9 p.m. Pacific, the same show if you want to tape it or tell your friends about this wonderful interview at bbsradio.com. So my name is Mike Schultz once again. I'm a professional tarot card reader. I do tarot readings by phone, so I'd definitely like to talk to all the members of the audience and contact me at my website, fountainsofyouth.net. That's fountainsofyouth.net. Now is my co-host, Candia, here.
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
I'm blown away. We had a bunch of snow this morning.
Isn't it awesome?
It's exciting. The sun is out. It looks really cool.
Oh, you know, I have a thing. I have four teenagers at my house this morning because school didn't happen. And I think that, talk about group manifesting, nobody wanted to go to school.
It's their fault, huh?
Oh, it's great. Well, you would think with sunshine that they would stay, that they would open the schools. But no, it's pretty icy.
That's amazing. So what's on your agenda today? What would you like to talk about?
What do I want to talk about? You know, it's funny, I was thinking about that, because I always like to think about what has been current with my clients. It usually goes in cycles, right?
Okay.
And so it's usually what is on the roadmap. So, but you know, it's been all over the board. It usually goes where every client for a week, their situations or issues are very much the same. Well, I think it's because we're at the beginning of group consciousness of a new year, right?
Okay.
That it's been everything from relationships to money to health. I mean, it has not been concentrated on any one issue, which I think is very fascinating because, again, as you know, we're all mirrors. You know, just think about it. What's going on in your world is usually going on in my world in some way.
We're connected.
We are connected. We are all connected. So I think the overriding thing this week has been relationships. Everybody wants to have good relationships. I mean, I don't know who doesn't. So, in fact, is that something that you work on yourself? I don't even know.
All the time, sure.
And I don't necessarily mean either just a partnership. It could be a relationship with your parents, your siblings, your kids, any kinds of relationships. Well, it kind of goes back into what I was talking about last week, is really working on this new, it's not a new paradigm. It's stuff we've been talking about for years, I guess, more than anything, just new terminology, the fact that it's become more of it's on everybody's tongues now, whereas before it was only a few of us out there that talked about creating our own reality. Now I think it's hit the mainstream a lot more. So, and the other thing, too, is all the teenagers, since they're not at school, they all got up early. They're all in on one of the video games, and it's such a perfect analogy because it's creating your own video game, your own paradigm of your own virtual reality. So if you start, and it goes back to relationships and health and finances, is if you create your own virtual reality every day and you breathe it in and get your controller out if you have to because you want that race car or you want that relationship, is to start really visualizing on your own screen so that you are a part of it. And the kids right now, they're so cute. They're such a great example for us because they go, okay, see that car? That's the car that I'm going to have. That's going to be my first car, and that race car is going to be my next my next car. And they get so into it that they become part of the screen itself, and yet their reality is still happening on the couch with their little controllers. But what's great is that they literally go and step into it to make it happen, to make it real. So that's how we truly manifest, is where you step into it. It's your own virtual reality game, because in so many ways that's what life is. It's just our own virtual reality, and we can change it every day with our minds. Does that make sense to you?
It does. So it's all about just visualizing, and I've heard that, you know, you really have to be in a good mood when you do this as well.
Well, you know, that does help. You know what? What's interesting about that is not everybody is in a good mood because, and living in the Northwest, I think, is a really good example of this. Our suicide rate is very high in the Northwest.
In the winter, probably.
And I really believe it's because we have so little sunshine. It does affect people's moods. So when that happens, trying to find the joy, because I think intrinsically our souls are happy. It's just that we lose our joy. And if our lives have been overridden by a lot of wild happenings, to say it nicely,
sure,
we tend to lose our joy and our happiness both. But if you can't, if you're not always in a good mood, if you're frustrated, it's almost the old adage, you got to fake it until you make it. And so when you get into that space, and I try and create a space every morning for myself for this type of reality check. If you can't get into that space of complete joy and happiness to create it, is then you go through everything in your life that you're grateful for. And that helps bring that energy up so that you feel more positive.
Uh-huh.
if that makes sense.
It does make a lot of sense. Just go back to your gratitude.
Mm-hmm. And then it does circle you back to your center to say, you know what, life really isn't that bad. Today, oh my God, it's sunny. How could you not be happy today? It's just absolutely, it's just staggeringly gorgeous outside. And I really think that helps lift up everybody's mood. And of course, then there are people who are, you know, think about the people in Southern California with their fires down there. We've been absolutely inundated with water, and they have no water down there.
Yeah, I know. We need balance. Now, when you were talking about your teenagers, and they said, I want to have a car, is that the wrong thing to say? Should they say, I already have a car?
Yeah, on one level, yes. But the fact, and it's my son, it's my almost 16-year-old that's saying this. He says it, that's going to be my first car. That's going to be my second car. So he says it in such a way that it's going to, he's visualizing. It's not, I want that car. No, that's going to be my first car. That's going to be my second car. And I love that thing. I mean, because he's been around me for almost 16 years. He's used to that kind of thing. And what's great, that spills off on the other kids. But it's also such a great reminder to the adults. He was just perfect for me this morning. I'm going, oh, there it is. It's the virtual reality. Because it's like when we go in, and I don't play games. They're on the screen on the television at this moment. However, I don't play games. But what we can do as adults that don't do those kinds of virtuality is to imagine going into a movie theater, and when you go into a theater, you immerse yourself in that movie, and yet you can talk to the person right next to you or reach for some popcorn or whatever. You're still within your own world, right? But you immerse yourself into that reality.
I see.
It's the same type of thing with life. When you step into that visualization, that world you become a part of, that's when you can make it and start to shift it within your own space to make it happen. And then, just like you said, that was a really good question. Is that how you make it happen, by wanting it? No, because the verb to want is always outside of us.
That means you go in to get wanting.
Uh-huh.
Now, let's take this to an extreme. Let's say a person broke their arm. Could they manifest a healing in one afternoon? Could they do that?
Well, in my belief pattern, absolutely. Because the body has that ability. Now, there was a book written, oh, golly, it's been at least 10-plus years ago, by Marla Morgan, Newton Message Down Under, all about her adventures down with the Aboriginals in Australia. Well, what's great about that particular book, that she had to actually make it as a fiction because she didn't have times and dates on it, and the publishers got really sideways about her, but I saw her when she came through town. Anyway, in that book, she was talking about that they showed her that that was possible. Somebody in the tribe broke their leg and the next day it was fine because they have the belief that you can do it. Our problem is we don't have the belief. I think individuals do, but there is still some lingering doubt there, and that's the only thing that limits us. I believe that we could be like the salamanders and grow an arm back if we needed to. We ourselves have that capability. We just don't have the belief yet. I have a sense, too, it's going to take, it's like the 100th monkey concept. You're going to have a few people who do it, but once it hits the 100th monkey, 100th person, is when it will start to expand into that consciousness of the whole so that everybody, oh, that's possible. Oh, my God, that's awesome. Because right now we totally buy into the paradigm of the medical institution and the insurance company. You know, it's. I was thinking about this the other day. I mean, that's a really good question because the other day on the news, you know, the news and and I don't watch the news that often, but I do like to stay just, okay, where's the mind thinking these days? Anyway, one of the commercials was on insurance programs, you know, and it's either an insurance commercial or it's a medical, this hospital, this drug, whatever. And it's become so much of our culture, it's so ingrained in our psyche that you need to be at the doctor's all the time. And if you go back to the late 1800s, or 300 years or 400 years, people didn't go to the doctor all the time and have their 35,000 checkups. We didn't do that, and yet that's part of our consciousness now, so that we've become a nation of sick people rather than a nation of healthy people. And if we could walk away from that and then move into this health consciousness of radiating the ability and the manifestation within their body, yes, that's when I believe that we could heal those bones.
And you hear about stories on the news once in a while of somebody whose arm does heal overnight, or, you know, someone who has terminal cancer and they are able to recover. You hear about it once in a while.
Yeah. Well, and you know what? How you do that too, especially like with cancer, is to it goes into that whole belief, a gratitude of how healthy you are. And I talked about this a little bit last week. The movie The Secret. In The Secret, there's a woman as one example that she said thank you for the healing for 3 months, and after 3 months she was cancer free, without any kind of radiation or without any kind of treatments whatsoever. So it goes back to that virtual reality, and that's how the reason I gave you that example is because that's something we can identify with, because some people cannot or are challenged with meditating, but this way it's an active meditation. It's a, you know, you can step into your own reality going, okay, now what is it that I really want to create? What's my world? And I'll do that when the weather is so gray. It's like, okay, I want blue sky today. So I will go, when I go do my gratitude, my morning, okay, what is it that I'm creating into my own little space? Mine always has blue sky, you know, the perfect day. That's a program as much as a tool that I use in some of my classes. Go into the perfect day. What is your perfect day? What does that speak to you? What does it say for you? I mean, okay, right off the cuff, Mike, what would be the top three things on your perfect day?
Well, blue sky, like you said, which I'm working with you on, and just having great interactions with people and having plenty of money to do what I want to do.
See, that's where every day then when you wake up, put that into your virtual reality. And just, being who I am, I can see you in your world doing just that. I can see you walking up and down the street, talking just to different people that you don't know. I can see you talking on the phone to people you do know. I see you going to, somebody's business that you're good friends with, and you go talk to them, and then you leave happy, and then you go to somebody's house. I can see you doing that. That's part of your reality, and that's absolutely a part of who you are.
Well, let me ask you. Sometimes I take a blank checkbook, and I've come upon this figure of $90,000 in my bank account. I'm not sure how I got that, but going over $100,000 didn't feel right to me. I didn't believe it, so I put 90, but I'm still having trouble. I stare at it, but I can't believe it.
See, you know, that is a really, there's something in that I think is really important, and that is the part where we limit ourselves. And I am no different. You know, I think we all are challenged with that and how we step outside of those blocks and that what has been, I call stuckness.
Right.
I work with stuck issues a lot. That's where I focus so much, because that's where we limit ourselves is with this stuckness of why can't we jump up and over the hurdle. And for you, that goes back to your childhood. I see your mom very much part of that as to where that came
from. Oh, their family went through the depression.
Yeah. But it's your dad, yes, but more your mom's, because of her belief system, and you as a child looking at your mom and watching that happen, it became part of your belief pattern. So what for you is a matter of going back and letting go of those old patterns that are not yours. They're not yours, they're your mom's, that you took on. If you move those out of there and then focus then on just you, you'll be able to go up and over.
That makes a lot of sense. I want you to tell the listeners a little bit more about your services and how you can help people over the phone, and then I'll let you go ahead and wind up the show.
Oh, you're awesome. You can contact me, Candia Sanders, at www.candiasanders.com or my phone, 360-608-9555. I work in person and over the phone on about everything. Actually, I sure haven't limited myself, because I get all kinds of people's issues, from addictions to child sexual abuse to financial issues to broken bones, cancer, you name it. I've autism, bipolar. There are I don't know if there's nothing. I think I've touched on every concept now. I have not put any limits in terms of what I can't work with, because all I do is access the universal energies and then direct it from your higher self to you. I'm just the facilitator. I just hold the magic wand. I'm not the magician. So, to me, I feel very honored and grateful every day for this gift. And it's really fun to work with different clients from all over, because everybody I work with teaches me something. I learn from everybody that I work with. So it's the greatest gift. So thank you for listening to Mike and I here at Odyssey. Please join us again tonight. And then stay tuned for us next week. Check out Mike's video. And if you haven't gotten it, please do go to his website for that.
Fountainsofyouth.net.
There we go.
And your website, CandiaSanders.com, and you can do a reading right over the phone.
Absolutely. They could call in. That would be really fun.
Okay, cool. We'll see you next week.
Thanks, Mike.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.